from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, with recent events transpiring in Darfur, we'll take stock of what is occurring there and we'll find out what kinds of actions are being taken and what's being proposed to deal with the genocide and the refugee crisis. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Conflict and famine have left some 200,000 people dead and 2 million displaced since the government of Sudan enlisted the Janjaweed Arab militia against the minority revolt that began in 2003. Despite a ceasefire, 10 African Union peacekeepers were killed just a week ago by rebel factions, heightening tensions and concern in the region. Attempts at negotiating a peace or bringing greater sanctions to end the violence continue. Elder statesmen have visited the Sudan looking for a peace breakthrough. And on October 27th, talks are slated to begin between rebel factions and the Sudanese government in Libya. Here in the United States, proposed congressional legislation to pull out investments supporting the Khartoum regime has faced opposition from Bush administration officials who argue for a hold-off on new sanctions because of what they view as progress toward a peacekeeping force and toward reconciliation talks going on in western Sudan. California and 14 other states, 5 cities, and 50 universities have pulled out of Sudan investments, but there are problems in the courts, which is why those backing federal legislation want to create a constitutionally based law for divestment through the proposed Western Sudan Divestment Authorization Act. Trillions in U.S. pension funds are at stake, and there is an ongoing trade embargo, as well as mounting pressure on China, the biggest purchaser of Sudan oil, with the threat of a boycott of next year's Beijing Olympics. In this forum hour, we turn our attention to Darfur, the genocide and the displacement, and what can be done. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. We want to welcome here in studio Mohammed Suleiman, who is an activist in the Bay Area Darfur Coalition. He's a native of the Darfur region of Sudan, and welcome. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you here. Also glad to have Jane Wells with us, who's president and CEO of the World Affairs Council. And in early September, Jane Wells visited refugee camps in eastern Chad as part of a delegation to investigate the plight of Darfuri refugees and internally displaced persons in Chad. Welcome, Jane Wells.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And we'll say good morning to Jason Miller, policy activist with the Sudan Divestment Task Force. Welcome. Glad to have you back here, Jason Miller.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And Mohammed Suleiman, I'm going to begin with you. And we had to mention that you're part of the Zaghawa tribe, as well as being part of the Darfur coalition. I think the thing I'd like to focus on initially is just how hard it is to get information and the lack of news, particularly internally, not only in Darfur, but really throughout the region.
Well, actually, the government in Sudan, really, it clamps or actually deprives any sort of information inside Sudan, and they tried many times to block even some of the internet websites, and even some of those, say like satellite stations, whether international or Arabs, is still it's not that easy to get in. But actually, they have a huge propaganda machine to counter all the, say like the facts that aired or seen on the TV, by saying or actually telling the people inside Sudan, all these actually you see in the TV, just a conspiracy from the Western countries, because they have some, they want to get into our oil and our natural resources.
And is it your perception right now that though the Bush administration is talking tougher where Darfur is concerned, that they really are concerned about the oil, that they want to, provide money in purchasing oil that will essentially go to weapons that are being used in the genocide?
Yes, and there is like actually the Bush administration sending confusing signals actually. In fact, you can consider it even encouraging the government of Khartoum to continue in genocide, because at one point The Bush administration said that what occurred in Darfur is genocide. But at the same time also, the sanctions that slapped on the government of Sudan back in May, it left the oil intact. I mean, even the revenue of the oil, it is coming freely in the hands of the regime there. And that actually what fuels the genocide, because by that money, they purchase weapons from China and continue bombarding the civilians in Darfur.
Ongoing bombing of civilians.
Yes.
And also driving so many into the camps.
More and more, actually, those refugee camps, they saw more floods, I mean, influx of the refugees get into those camps. So actually, something has to be really taken seriously in order to address the problem of how they can really deprive the government of Sudan from this free oil money that actually fueling the genocide. Unless something taken directly and drastically, genocide will continue.
Sanctions and divestment do have efficacy. They do work.
They are working. And divestment actually, we are actually hoping that it will affect China, because it started to respond, but the response is not as fast and huge as we wanted. But they started to really think that, okay.
Well, China signed on for the Libya talks that are coming up, for example, have they not?
Yes. Yeah. But actually, even the talks in Tripoli in Libya, we consider it like, when I say we, like the regular Darfurians, as a waste of time, because the government of Sudan, till now, it has signed two agreements, and none of those agreements actually, the government of Sudan is genuinely executing them. In fact, the CPA is in troubles now.
The government of Sudan has reneged on almost everything that it's promised to do along the lines of doing something about the situation or diminishing it. And the fact is, maybe that government has to be dismantled. I mean, this is what I'm hearing from certainly many people who are concerned and who are activists.
Exactly. That's the root cause of the problem, the government. And when you understand, actually, how the structure of the government, then you can understand why Sudan is in turmoil, because the elite, or there's like a few minority elite who are controlling the government of Sudan, and their interest only can be advanced if the Sudan is in turmoil or in chaos. That's how they can really reach to the natural resources, which these natural resources are actually in the areas of the marginalized people. So by having these elite people in the central government, Sudan will know no peace. There will be no peace in Sudan, and especially in Darfur. And they are willing and ready to sign agreement after agreement, but they are not going to honor it or actually implement it.
Mohamed Soliman, again with us in studio, is with the Bay Area Darfur Coalition and a native of the Darfur region of the Sudan, member of the Zaghawa tribe. And Jane Wales is here with us as well this morning, and she's President and CEO of the World Affairs Council, and as I said, visited refugee camps in eastern Chad as part of a delegation that was made up of 8 women, 5 of them Africans, and went to eastern Chad. And millions have been displaced, we ought to mention. Only an inclusive peace agreement can really put a stop to this, I guess, as you see things now, Jane.
Yes, and I agree with Mohammed's assessment that that would be exceedingly hard to achieve, because too many key actors believe it's not in their interests. He has described what many refer to in this country and others as the resource curse. What we learned when we were in Chad is that there's a combination of problems. There are really two crises going on, the crisis in Darfur and a crisis that is taking place in neighboring Chad, which has become increasingly lawless. You're in situations in which the militia, first of all, it should be noted that the tribes do cross borders, and so these borders only have a minor relevance. So the tensions cross borders, but also the refugees, of course, are over in Chad, where there can be UN camps. At the same time, there's the internally displaced of Chad. So you've got the Darfuris in UN camps. You've got the Chadians in camps set up by Chad's government, the government of President Deby. I think the key question for us when we came away is whether you could have a deployment of a UN African Union hybrid force in Darfur without any kind of protective force in Chad, because our sense was that if you did that, it would be like squeezing one side of a balloon. It would only expand the other side, and you'd be moving the locus of the violence from Darfur to Chad. You wouldn't be resolving it. So we came away pressing for a European Union deployment that would be simultaneous with the UN.
Well, hasn't there been a lot of indictment of ineffectuality from the AU, from just the forces on the ground of the AU?
You know, that has been really striking to me. I mean, one of the things that stood out was the lack of legitimacy of the AU in the eyes of anybody who backs any of the rebel forces, in the eyes, in fact, of many. That was perhaps one of the most discouraging things that we learned. In the camps, the men were very quick. They were quick to simply dismiss AU forces as ineffectual, and to dismiss Salim Salim, who's the negotiator on behalf of the African Union, as not really being, in their eyes, balanced. They see Salim Salim as pressing hard on the rebel leaders, but not pressing similarly hard on Bashir, which of course is a problem with any negotiation when you've got a third party. If there's perceptions on the behalf of the warring parties that they are being pressed harder than the other.
Well, you spoke to a rebel leader in Paris, in fact.
Yes, we did have a side meeting, and then I had a private meeting with Abdel Wahid, who is rebel leader of the SLM in Darfur. He is in exile in Paris. He is a leader with quite a backing, who has determined that it is not in his own interests to engage in the peace talks that are being planned for Tripoli. He has his own political ambitions, and does not believe that they would be well served. At least that is what he shared with us, that they would not be well served by entering into these negotiations. So that was a not a heartening conversation, to say the least.
Speaking of non-heartening conversations, you had a lot of conversations with young women in Chad and discovered there's been a serious and ongoing problem with rape and brutality, and in addition to the displacement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, here you've got, you know, these are people who've gone over to Chad in search of a combination, you know, both security and dignity. And they have neither. The women are not safe. Nor the men, for that matter. The women go out for firewood in the early morning. They go because if the men go, the men might get killed. If the women go, they get raped. It is a very dangerous life that they lead. In addition, for the women who come from Darfur, we'll stick with them for a moment rather than the Chadians. The women who come from Darfur, who have been victims of rape, have had multiple losses. Their children have been murdered in front of them, and often their husbands have divorced them because under Sudanese law, rape is the same thing as adultery. I mean, it's treated in the same way under the law. And so sometimes they have lost their husbands as well as their children, as well as their homes and as their sense of self. I should say, though, that as horrifying it was to hear the tales that they had to retell, and as horrifying as it has been to follow what they have been through, what women have been through in conflicts around the world, I was personally most struck by their resilience. These are not people who have given up. These are not people who've just given in to the indignities and cruelty that they've suffered. And in my view, these are people who are absolutely a necessary part of any peace agreement and of any plans for post-conflict.
These are many, in many cases, people who don't want to go back to Darfur.
Oh, they don't want to go back to Darfur. It's not safe, but they need to be part of... And the memories are horrifying, but they need to be part of any post-conflict reconciliation. They're essential to it. These are brave women who have their own sense of dignity, you know, separate and apart from the cruelty that they have endured.
Jane Wales again with us in studio as President and CEO of the World Affairs Council, and in September was part of a delegation that visited refugee camps in eastern Chad. Jason Miller is a policy advisor with the Sudan Divestment Task Force. And are you hopeful about Libya?
I want to be hopeful about Libya because it's an opportunity to get the rebels together, to negotiate with the Sudanese government. But there are so many obstacles in the way. Just today or yesterday, one of the two main rebel movements in Darfur, the Justice and Equality Movement, announced that they're splitting. Already, the other rebel movement, the Sudan Liberation Army, has split multiple times over. So many splits and reorganizations that you can't even really keep track of who's leading who.
And there was a region that was raised that was written up in this morning's paper as a result of retaliation by
Khartoum
against these. And rebels are attacking peacekeepers? Why are they doing that?
Right. So the region you're talking about is the Haskanita region. And it's alleged that rebels attacked African Union peacekeepers, although it hasn't been confirmed and the African Union is currently investigating that issue. But then in potential retaliation, or it's unclear why, the Sudanese government cleared the entire village of its population, 15,000 people, in the last couple of days. So the reason, why are the rebels attacking the African Union? Partly, as Jane mentioned, they perceive the African Union as playing favorites. I think partly it's an opportunistic reason. They need weapons in order to fight the government, and the African Union provides them the sort of supplies and weapons that they would need to fight. And part of it is truly that there's a divide among the rebels between those that genuinely want a sort of peace and autonomy for Darfur and those that are purely opportunistic, similar to the way many of the Janjaweed militias have been opportunistic in Darfur. They see spoils that can be gained. And so it's really created this morass of a problem where you're trying to get a bunch of factions together, some of whom have really venerable goals and some of whom have purely profit goals, both on the rebel side and the government side. And that's why I want Libya to work, but why I also see it as a hugely complicated situation.
And are we going to get some legislation moving forward on divestment, federal legislation that'll frame things so that many of the states like California can go ahead and do what they want to do or feel they need to do?
Right. So the legislation that's currently being considered in the Senate will do three things. The first is it will authorize states to divest, as you mentioned. The second is it will prohibit federal contracts to be granted to companies that meet certain very specific criteria. And I want to emphasize that this legislation is only dealing with a very small number of companies operating in Sudan. There are over 500 multinationals in Sudan, most of whom are contributing to are either neutral in the country or contributing to economic development. But there's a few key companies that are truly the lifeline, financial lifeline and support line of the Sudanese government and have in the past either participated or been willfully ignorant of human rights abuses in the country. And the legislation that's currently being considered in Congress is targeting those very few companies. So it would authorize states to divest from those few companies. It would prohibit federal contracts from those companies. And it would allow investment companies to build investment products, mutual funds and other sorts of investment products that are free from those problematic companies. We know it's having an effect. Just last week, our organization announced a breakthrough with the largest mining firm in Sudan in which they have promised not to take on any new operations in Sudan until the Sudanese government implements the full UN African Union hybrid force without obstructing it at all. And they are also increasing their humanitarian aid to Darfur to help offset some of what they view as the problematic actions of the Sudanese government. So we know the legislation can have an effect. We have met resistance by the State Department, however.
Jason Miller, again, is policy advisor for the Sudan Divestment Task Force. And Julia Spiegel is with us also, a policy analyst with Enough, the project to abolish genocide and mass atrocities. They were a group that was launched in March and do field analysis and direct high-level diplomacy, not only in Darfur, but in eastern Congo and northern Uganda, a grassroots movement. And I say proudly that Julia was an intern with us here at KQED. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning, Michael. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. Well, there are a lot of challenges now with humanitarian aid, and I know that your organization wants to protect and make peace and punish, and we'll talk about maybe where punishment comes in, but let's talk first about protecting humanitarian aid. What are we doing to protect the humanitarian aid workers? What do we need to do?
Well, again, there's been some discussion of the deployment of this hybrid force would be a joint operation between the African Union and the United Nations. I think the silver lining, if anything, on this attack on Haskanida on the African Union base is that it demonstrates the urgent need for the U.S. and other donors to provide the necessary equipment and firepower to enable this hybrid force to deploy to Darfur as soon as possible and to be able to protect civilians and those humanitarian aid workers. Because as you mentioned earlier, there are 4 million people in the Darfur region dependent on aid for survival, plus an additional 1 million beyond the reach of any sort of aid organization.
There is a UN bill that's authorizing hybrid force, 1769, correct?
Yes.
And what's the status of where the United Nations is behind all this?
So right now what we see is actually plenty of troop contribution offers, which was surprising since if this is fully operationalized, it'll be the largest peacekeeping operation in the world today. But the dilemma is that many of the countries that have offered these troops do not have men who are fully equipped or fully trained. So what we actually need right now is more technical logistical support so that there can be both African and non-African troops. Since this is a test case and we've never really had a hybrid force of this nature between the United Nations and the African Union, there are some kinks that need to be worked out, particularly in terms of command and control and, as I said, the makeup of the force between African and non-African troops.
So we're really in a holding pattern.
At this point, yes. I mean, we need more. We need the U.S. particularly. I mean, in rhetoric, the U.S. has said that it's very supportive of the deployment of the hybrid force. I think in action, they could show this much more by pressing other United Nations Security Council members to be more forthcoming in terms of providing that technical logistical support and even paying our own peacekeeping arrears to support the mission so it can deploy as soon as possible. Another component of that is pressuring Khartoum, because what we've seen is that time and time again, they have been throwing up sort of institutional bureaucratic roadblocks that slow down the process by limiting access to land and water, by delaying visa approvals. And individually, these look like just minor impediments, but cumulatively, it shows a strategy of obstruction that could seriously delay the deployment.
And your group is also trying to put pressure on Beijing?
Pressure in the sense of constructive pressure, yes. We think that the Beijing Olympics provide a unique opportunity to work with China when they are at a moment where they really care about their public image and democratization and so on, and that we can work constructively with them behind the scenes to pressure Khartoum.
And we should also mention, I think the Security Council deadline for the United Nations to assume command and control of peacekeeping operations is December 31st.
That's correct.
Julia Spiegel, again, is a policy analyst with Enough, the project to abolish genocide and mass atrocities, also former KQED intern with us from Washington. You can be with us, and in fact, we invite your phone calls. We'd like to hear your thoughts about what's going on in Darfur, any questions you may have, and not only Darfur, but also in Chad with the refugee displacement crisis that is ongoing, that Jane Wales has a great deal of information to impart to us. You can join us now at our toll-free number, and you're welcome to do so. It's 866-733-6786. Phone lines are open to you, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, and we welcome your calls. Again, it's toll-free 866-733-6786, or send an email to us. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. Talking with Jane Wales from the World Affairs Council, with Mohammed Suleiman from the Bay Area Darfur Coalition, Jason Miller from the Sudan Divestment Task Force, and Julia Spiegel of Enough. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're examining the current situation in Darfur, particularly in the wake of a violent attack by rebels on African peacekeepers and contentious visit to the region by some of the world's most prominent elder statesmen, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu and former President Jimmy Carter. And you are welcome to join us here if you have some thoughts about the crisis there, if you have any questions. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786, or you can email us forum@kqed.org. Jane, can you give us kind of a briefing on the what happened with the elders? I mean, this was supposed to at least move things forward, wasn't it?
Well, I think that they discovered some things that are both known to you and some things that may be new. I think most importantly, they found that President Bashir remains in denial, that he does not understand that the international community is finally beginning to mobilize and that he no longer can call the shots about the nature of the deployment that will come in. He has been arguing, for example, that the UNAU hybrid force must be composed entirely of Africans. And as you've heard from earlier comments, these are not necessarily the forces that are most best trained and best equipped or that have the greatest legitimacy on the ground. They also visited, of course, with the way we had done in Chad. They visited with folks who were not only responsible for the conflict, but those who had been affected by the conflict, to gain a sense of whether they could have a voice at the table. And Grasa Machel, the former First Lady of both Mozambique and then later of South Africa, was very forceful in arguing that women's voices need to be heard. Jimmy Carter made very much the same point. They found, of course, that despite their standing, the standing of Archbishop Tutu, the standing of Lakhdar Brahimi and others on the mission, that they had their own problems with the Sudanese government. President Bashir had told them that they would have total access, that they could go wherever they wished. And, of course, that was not the case. They were blocked from visiting refugees. You probably read in the press that Jimmy Carter had some words with the hapless guard who blocked him. But in fact, in the end, they didn't have entirely all the free rein they wanted.
One of the problems here, Mohamed Suleiman, is everybody seems to want to be at the table. I mean, there are new groups and new factions breaking off all the time.
Well, actually, at this point, I think instead of the peace talks, they need more two things: security, especially the people inside the camps and inside Darfur, and also they need justice, because so far now, the people in the camps, they have been there for like 5 years, I mean some of them 4 years, and they have been subjected to a very brutal suppression from the government agents. They have been organizing themselves, and now they know actually, and as Jane said, they are very resilient people. They are really, the government wants to break them by all this harassment and the rapes and torture and so forth, but still they are standing up. The other side also, some of these rebel groups, some of them they are genuine and some of them they are really after their own ambitious goals. The way we see it actually, the international community has to really bypass them and go directly to the people in the camps. And they have to empower those people, especially the women, because they are the most who actually suffered under this genocide. And they have to really give them a say, and at the same time also consult with them. How do you want these problems to be solved? Because there is a lot of anger simmering inside and bitterness and all the grievances that has to be addressed. Also about the justice. There is a warrant of arrest issued, you know, by the International Criminal Court, and the government actually dragging their feet not to give those individuals to the justice. In fact, it is thumbing its nose in the face of the international community by appointing one of the guys as the Minister of Humanitarian. This is the same guy, Ahmed Haroun, who was actually responsible of the atrocities and genocide. And he's the one who actually put these people in the camps. Now the government of Khartoum appointed him as humanitarian minister, in charge of these people who actually his victims.
Let me go to our callers, and we'll begin with Robert. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Oftentimes, most of the time when I hear conversations such as this on Sudan, it usually shifts to it's the government of Sudan. And my question is would it, the campaign, the program to stop some of the violence be assisted if there were an actual face put on this government? I notice when campaigns are put forward that other governments, especially in this government, they want to move against a particular entity. They don't use the term government any longer. It becomes a face. Saddam Hussein becomes Hitler. Tojo becomes another evil entity, etc. So if it's diffused, oftentimes people can become confused and don't become as attached. So I'm just asking in terms of adding to the assistance of getting public opinion to become more focused. And the other question is there an active campaign of the groups that are trying to bring peace and stability to the Sudan region to follow the candidates that are currently running for president, example, and every time there's a group that stands up and asks, what will you do about this, once again, using the individual's name, who they're going to put at the leadership of this, and if the candidate refuses to answer within a certain amount of stops, then the press would begin to have to take notice because the event would become too repetitious. Or, of course, you can always arrest those people, but that would start to stand out as well.
Well, Robert, let's find out, particularly from a couple of our grassroots policy advisors here. Jason Miller, what about putting a human face on some of the leadership in Darfur and making your campaign make Americans and those in the West particularly more aware of who we're talking about here, who the villains are?
I think it is an important point. I mean, the head of Sudan is President Omar al-Bashir. There's unquestionably he controls the way things operate. There is a lot of internal tension within the party that he controls, and so he has to balance a bunch of different kind of vying factions. But the bottom line is that he is the face of Sudan. He has, for example, claimed there's only 9,000 deaths in Darfur. He is the one who says that it's Western interest in Darfur is all about trying to go in and practice neocolonialism again. So in some ways, he should be the face of the Darfur genocide, and for that matter, the civil war that happened previous to the Darfur genocide in the north-south. In terms of the second question about following presidential candidates, that's actually something our parent organization, which is called the Genocide Intervention Network, does. We indeed encourage local communities, when presidential candidates visit those local communities, to ask particular questions of the presidential candidates. And in fact, we even rate all of Congress in terms of scorecards on whether or not they have an A, B, C, D, or F on their activism regarding genocide. And no one, literally no one, wants an F when it comes to genocide activism. So I think that's also a very important point.
And Julia Spiegel, what about enough on this point?
To go back to the faith issue, I mean, I think you'd see a lot of pushback from the U.S. government in terms of using Bashir's faith, because something that's become ever more prevalent is our relationship with Bashir and his regime in terms of counterterrorism information. So while publicly we occasionally show disdain for, you know, what Bush and Colin Powell and others have called genocide, we also have close relations with them in terms of gaining more counterterrorism information. So I can tell you that I think the U.S. government would be not very happy with the notion of attaching Bashir's face, although he and a few others we know are the key people responsible for ongoing atrocities.
And we'll get more of our callers on. We'll go to Harry next. Harry, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks a lot. There's two things. First of all, I used to hear some reference to religious aspects to this conflict, which I don't hear anymore. I know the Christians were in one area and they seem to have been mollified or taken care of, but now they're raising their heads again. I wonder, I'd like to hear more current description of the religious aspects to this problem. But secondly, and most importantly, is does anybody have a vision of how this ends other than just trying to protect the people who are at risk?
Both good questions. Can you, Mohammed Salaman, talk about the religious conflict and how it's ongoing in your judgment?
Well, actually, I mean, this brings us back to the root cause of the problem, where actually there's like people who actually ethnically are controlling Sudan since the independence 1956. And these elite are actually from the north region, north of Khartoum. So in the south, they use the religion card in order to, go to the war against Saudis. And the main thing is, like, actually, it is all a struggle of power, of keeping power and wealth. In Darfur, when Darfurian people started to rise up, they cannot use the religion card here because most of the Darfurians are Muslims. So here it came the ethnic card, where actually Arabs against Africans. So the government in Khartoum, which is actually controlled by this elite, they use different cards and even nationalism at one point if they cannot use the other two cards. So at the end, it is a problem of keeping the power and wealth just within the elite area.
Jane Wells, caller also raised a question about envisioning peace. We talked before about a peace agreement, and a peace agreement is something that would be presumably pretty fragile because this Khartoum government has not lived up to any of its promises. Just because something's on paper doesn't mean that we're going to find them obliged to do so in the future. I mean, how do we envision peace in this region other than regime change?
Well, I mean, I think that's part of the reason that that President al-Bashir does not see it as being particularly in his interest, is the sense that that this capacity to play groups against each other in order to maintain his own control over the wealth of the country is one of the largest problems. It's also a large problem with some rebel leaders who don't see it as in their interest. Ultimately, though, because it is, you know, fortunately, the international community has been mobilized, and so that it has got the potential of creating a sufficient degree of security on the ground to allow actual peace talks to take place. I don't have a great deal of hope, and I'd love to hear Jason on this. I don't have or Mohammed as well, and Julia. I don't have as much hope that a peace process that precedes any kind of level of security can make much progress.
But you think a hybrid force could move us in that direction?
It needs to
be incremental
if
in that
it moves
sense.
Quickly. Yeah. If it moves quickly, the two points, other points I'd like to make, and the first is that I think Mohammed's point can't be stressed enough, that all conflicts do require political opportunists. And there are political opportunists who are using, as in his words, the ethnic card, the religious card. They're using various divisive
a lot of other cards, jokers, in fact, that metaphor of card playing.
But in fact, in the end, it is about acquiring and maintaining power. It is about acquiring and maintaining wealth, and this is not unique to Sudan. This was true with Milosevic in the former Yugoslavia. This is true in every civil conflict that you see. That the bottom line is, or the nationalist card, as you mentioned, that Milosevic used so well. The bottom line is, this is a political struggle.
Let me thank Harry for his call and go to more of your calls. And again, you're welcome to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or via email. Got some emails coming in here, which I hope to read in a moment. Email address is forum@kqed.org. And Mark, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, this is Mark Brecky. I just want to thank you for keeping this in the news. I know 2007 has kind of dropped off. My question is, though, I should mention I was part of the first wave of photographers and filmmakers in 2004 in Darfur. My question is, I believe the Bush administration, of course, has been working on counterterrorism, like one caller mentioned. And do you think that's one of the main obstacles with this, trying to get information of bin Laden's stay there from 92 to 96? And it continues to get bits and pieces of information from the Khartoum government, but at the same time, the Bush administration is calling it genocide. is demonizing the government. And it's also noted that the U.S. Government is building the largest embassy, U.S. embassy, in Khartoum as we speak. And also down in, you know, in Khartoum, there's basically an economic boom where the Chinese embassy, basically hotels and luxury golf courses that are being built. And can you address those issues?
You bring up a lot of points, salient points. So, Jason Miller, can we at least respond to some of the points brought up by Mark?
I think it's one of those ultimate ironies that Sudan remains on our state sponsor of terrorism list, according to the State Department, and at the same time, one of the most recent reports to Congress reported that Sudan has been a fantastic partner on the war against terrorism. So we clearly have this sort of inherent paradox that we gain tidbits of counterterrorism intelligence from Sudan, and they know that that's valuable to us, and in some ways that may mitigate how forcefully we deal with Sudan. But there is a fundamental truth, which is that the U.S. long ago, because of the sanctions they put on Sudan and because of the lack of really any presence in Sudan, and also because of our standing in the world, has much less leverage with regards to Sudan than, for example, does some of Sudan's Asian partners, China and India and Malaysia. So the real question is what type of pressure is the U.S. going to put on some of these Asian partners who then have a straight, direct financial line into the Khartoum government and therefore can be quite influential?
We're talking about the ongoing crisis in Darfur, and here's an email from Craig who says, is anyone talking about partition of Sudan into two countries to permanently resolve this conflict? Wouldn't that be the best solution when the people of the South can be in charge of their own security within their own country? Julia Spiegel, what do you think?
I think many people from the South embrace that idea. However, I think that a large part of the reason why you've seen such a disproportionate use of force against both rebel factions in the South in the early 1990s and now in Darfur is because that's exactly what the government of Sudan does not want. And most of the oil wealth is in the South, for example, and that has been a serious source of contention in terms of implementation of the 2005 peace agreement. But ultimately, that is what is going to make them respond even more rationally, or I suppose it's rational in their sense, in that they want to maintain as much control and as much power as possible. So ultimately, partitioning the country, you will see a fight to the death between the Sudanese government and the South, if that's the area that he's discussing. Yeah. In Darfur, it doesn't seem that they want to be a separate entity. They just want more representation and oil and wealth sharing, power sharing.
Let me thank Mark for his call. And go back to Mohammed Suleiman, again, of the Bay Area Darfur Coalition, a native of the region. Your family's still there. Just how threatened or how under pressure are they presently? Family and friends, I should say.
Well, actually, my mother and sisters and brothers, they're in the big cities, actually mainly in Al Fasher. And the big cities actually relatively safer than the rural areas.
The rural regions. Yeah.
Because actually the dignitaries and at the same time also the international media and the NGOs, mostly they pass through the big cities. So the government is like under pressure not to do something that, you know, to jeopardize their image, which is already tarnished. But my tribe actually suffered a lot because actually most of the warriors actually from the Gao tribe, and the government actually dealt with the our area there in the north of Darfur very harshly, and almost all the villages and towns are burned, erased by the Janjaweed and the Antonov bombardments. So it is like even the Zagawa, this in general, the Zagawa Masalit and the four educated personnel or people actually in Khartoum, the capital, is still there harassed there by the government. But back in Darfur, these are the areas where actually, or these are the three tribes which actually suffered a lot.
I want to get more of our callers on here. And Neil, join us. Good morning.
Yeah, hello. I traveled through Darfur some 30 years ago. And I must say that, we can't very well characterize these the Arabs. It's sort of Arabs versus Africans, but non-Arab Africans. But they're all black people of one sort or another. There's some differences, but still black. And also, as somebody pointed out, there are both sides are Muslim. So it's a little hard to disentangle that aspect. And I must say, I don't think How long now we've been discussing this point, this whole issue for several years now, and nothing's been done, and I don't see anything. It's just too complicated and difficult, and the Bush administration has too many problems, and so I don't think we're ever going to do anything for a long time about it.
Well, understood. There's a note of hopelessness in that call, and thanks for that, Neil. But it has been going on since 2003. I'm wondering, when we had Nobel laureate Wally Cienega on, he kept emphasizing the Arab League. The Arab League is the key to maybe moving things forward. Jane Wales, you see
well,
things?
The Arab League has been a disappointing player for not weighing in forcefully. The two most disappointing players that are not kind of on the ground players or are outside forces are the Arab League and China. Each of whom has influence, each of which has influence of its own sort that it has chosen not to wield. I should note, though, that I am less discouraged. All of us are probably around this table are less discouraged. We have seen great movement. Note that even the Chinese are moving. They have, on the one hand, offered 200 personnel to the hybrid force. They have not blocked the hybrid force as they might have in the past. And one of the achievements of the elders on the ground was to get an assurance from the Chinese that they would provide several million dollars for the reconstruction of the company, of the country. That's an interesting slip. It may be the perspective of the Chinese as well, since their relationship is so heavily commercial with Sudan. So it is because it is so based on oil. But even the Chinese have moved. Let me just say one more thing, and I think this may be harder for Jason and Julia to say, and that is that there has been an extraordinary mobilization of public opinion on the part of organizations like the Genocide Intervention Network and Enough, and even social networks like Youth Noise and now Facebook. It is quite extraordinary the level of consensus in this country, the level of knowledge in this country of this conflict and its capacity to spread. And, you know, this is included members of the faith-based community that have put real pressure on the Bush administration to take very strong stands. So I think that, you know, when I say very strong stands, I mean compared to where they were. You remember that President Bush, when he ran for office in 2000, said Rwanda was not in our strategic interest. We were right not to act. This was a man who thought that was the case. He no longer thinks that. He thinks we have a role to play.
Could you speak for a moment about what you just alluded to as the possibility of the spreading and just what the dangers are there?
Well, my great fear, because in fact these borders have no meaning in many senses, we're already seeing the conflict spilling over into Chad. My fear is that ultimately it'll spill over into Central African Republic, CAR. The presidents of Chad and Sudan are each supporting rebels in the other's country. This is President Deby and President Bashir are each supporting rebel forces in the country of the other. This lawlessness is spreading. What I saw myself firsthand in Chad was basically a lawless land.
Jason Miller,
if I can add that we've already seen what happens when lawlessness spreads in Africa. Just look to the Democratic Republic of Congo, which brought in at one point in time so many different countries and so many different factions, and we're still struggling, even after a $500 million UN-sponsored vote, with lawlessness and violence of unbelievable proportions in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
And we're going to talk with a woman, in fact, from the Congo in our next hour when we cast some light on women who are doing work, extraordinary work, in darkness.
And here we have a situation which is spread somewhat, but can still be contained if we put all of our diplomatic weight behind this initiative. So the worst outcome is, believe it or not, worse than what currently exists right now. And it's only because of the activism and policies, attention that's been paid to Sudan, that it hasn't gotten worse.
Chuck, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks a lot. I was hoping you could give us some idea as to a set of principles that might be agreed upon internationally to govern the interactions between the nations that consume these resources and the nations that produce them. It's been a very unhappy history, not just in Darfur. If there were some principles that could govern those interactions that would be beneficial to everybody, I'd be interested to hear them.
Well, perhaps we should go to you, Julie, on this. You've got the three P's, protection, peacemaking, and punishment. How about principles?
What we argue is that in a crisis situation like this, those are the three critical elements. Obviously, we've been talking about peacemaking and protection extensively. The third one, punishment, I think is where we have that point of leverage to really move forward on peace and civilian protection. What we've seen with the Bush administration is that we've pursued various policies unilaterally, against a couple mid-level guys and various companies. But what we need is more multilateral targeted pressures combined with assertive and robust diplomacy to really pressure both the rebels and the Sudanese government to take the talks seriously so they feel that this is their best and only option.
And those principles in terms of multilateral would include what, for example, right at the top?
Primarily asset freezes, travel bans. I think there's both an economic component to it, and also it sends a very strong political message internationally.
I want to thank all our guests, Julia Spiegel, who is a policy analyst with Enough. Good to talk to you, Julia, and thank you so much for being with us. Project to Abolish Genocide and Mass Atrocities. Jason Miller here with us in studio, policy advisor with the Sudan Divestment Task Force. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
Mohamed Suleiman, activist with the Bay Area Darfur Coalition and a native of the Darfur region of the Sudan. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
And Jane Wales, president and CEO of the World Affairs Council. Thank you, Jane. And thanks to you, our listeners. We're appreciative of your listenership. Grateful to be with you every day, Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We'd like to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Dave Freeman. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Another hour of Forum coming your way. Thank you again for being here. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.